an individual poses a threat of harm only to themselves, the executive believes that there are better options available than making an arrest. This doesn't mean that officers should do nothing. To the contrary, officers will be expected to offer resources and outreach services to the individual and to closely coordinate with LEAD, REACH, We Deliver Care, and the myriad of other programs that are part of the city's public safety framework.
That's Andrew Meyerberg, Special Projects Director with the Mayor's Office, breaking down the new plan for a Seattle city ordinance that covers public drug use and drug possession. So how will the City Council consider that legislation as they attempt to get out of a mess created back in June when they could not agree on passing this measure? And we've talked about cameras to catch speeders and cut back on street racing. Well, what about cameras to slow people down in school zones up to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Plus, why is City Hall so worried about a budget gap that's coming 2 years from now? A lot to think about here on Seattle News, Views, and Brews, your coffee break political podcast. I'm Brian Callanan. I'm a host on Seattle Channel, and the views expressed here are mine. And my co-host is none other than the incredible David Croman, who is a transportation reporter for the Seattle Times and has decided to take it to the streets today. David, you are out in Ballard, so I know we're going to hear some background noise there, but what's shaking in that fine part of the western part of Seattle?
Yeah, well, out here for reporting, but the result is I have to be sitting outside and you're going to get a little street noise, so just to add to the ambiance.
That's all part of the fun. I did want to point out, I noticed you had a recent post about higher public transit ridership during the Taylor Swift concert weekend, and my story pitch was this. You travel the country following the Taylor Swift Eras Tour completely by public transit and see if you survive. Good idea or great idea? What do you think?
Yeah, great idea if I could find someone to finance my tickets to Taylor, my $1,500 tickets to Taylor Swift.
No doubt, no doubt. You'd have to interview her, too. There's no other way around it. Well, thank you, David. Thank you always for joining me here. Thanks also to our background noise sponsor, City Grind Espresso, on the first floor of City Hall. Thanks also to our show patrons. Hoping to have more of you listeners become patrons. That's how this show really survives, folks. Join us at the $5 level, and we will send you a wonderful podcast sticker just for you. We also feature our patrons' sticker shots, photos of their decals in action on our podcast as part of the video version of this show on Converge Media, our partner who airs this podcast Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much, Converge. All right, let's get rolling with right here, right now. Well, at long last, David, the council is considering the mayor's new proposal for an ordinance regarding drug possession and public drug use. Now, first things first, it appears the council will not be jamming this into a full vote before the council's two-week break coming up here in the last 2 weeks of August. So the city's in a little bit of no man's land legally here, at least until September, because the state's law on this, a gross misdemeanor for these offenses with a focus on treatment, kicks in August 15th. I want to put that aside just for now, David, because I just want to get your point of view on the bigger issue here for me, what the mayor is calling more clarity for police officers. So if a person using drugs is a harm to others, make an arrest on gross misdemeanor charges. If that person is a harm just to themselves, let's not worry about the criminal charges. Let's get them into treatment. I'm just trying to figure out, what is that going to look like on the street? Do you think this really gives officers clarity, or how messy is this going to be?
Well, I mean, you know, the arrest decisions are always pretty subjective. You know, we know that. And regardless of whether or not there's language specifying that, you know, you see certain things prosecuted more than others. I'm sure we could find some laws on the books that never get prosecuted. So
sure.
In that sense, it's not, I would say, all that rare to have that level of subjectivity. But, you know, this is a really sensitive subject. And, you know, I mean, I think there is already a sort of tension between police on the street and the decisions that prosecutors make down the road. And so, you know, I guess I could see some people having some concerns about putting the responsibility in the hands of officers on the street to decide what is a threat to others and what is somebody who's somebody who needs treatment. You know, it's when there's kind of openness around those sort of major decisions, those are the sort of things you want to track pretty closely.
Yeah, I will say the council and the mayor's office has gone to lengths to say that an officer encounters this person on the street, basically probable cause of the infraction has already been recorded. It's like, okay, there's some public use. There's some possession that's happening right here. So we've established that, but it's that next step that's going to be the interesting one here. And I just wanted to keep going down this path, David, because Councilmember Peterson also raised a concern this week. There was a public safety meeting on this on Monday, and this was this idea that is the city of Seattle essentially creating some sort of different standard with this, a law that really isn't in line with what the state debated with this special session and all that, as we've talked about the Blake decision earlier this year. I think the whole idea from the state was, we don't want a patchwork of different drug laws, but then here comes Seattle. So I guess I'm just looking at this. Do you see any part of what the mayor is proposing, what the council is considering here, as fundamentally different from the state law? I think that's a big question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, again, it'll sort of depend on how it plays out on the ground, I would have to think. I think there was always going to be, you know, back to what I was saying before about how enforcement tends to have a level of subjectivity no matter what. I think there was always going to be some level of patchwork to this. There has been for a long time, you know.
Yeah.
Seattle was the first to stop prosecuting marijuana before it was legal.
Right,
you know,
possession, right.
And so, you know, there's always going to be a certain level of that. You know, how that plays out on the ground, you know, having this ordinance, I think, will make it less of a patchwork than not having it. So that's for sure. Will it sort of put Seattle in the same ballpark as, I don't know, Yakima, for example? I doubt it.
Yeah, right. No, I think different cities are going to prosecute this different ways. And I do think the mayor, with his proposal, is trying at the very least to speak to the spirit of what the state was trying to pass here and what the governor was talking about when it comes to replying with or responding to the situation with treatment first and then coming in with that enforcement, the criminal enforcement piece second. I really do want to point out, folks, this was a very interesting public safety committee meeting, actually also looking at gaps in the fentanyl treatment services that are available to Seattleites. Or some extra viewing this week. Councilmember Herbold is working on a mobile opioid services unit. More on that to come. I'm talking with her about this on my Council Edition show on Seattle Channel this month. Watch for that next week. All right, we have a lot more to consider here, David, and I did want to talk about this with you as well, including a proposal for more traffic safety cameras. We've been talking about this, the council approving this measure to put in more speeding cameras in areas where we see a lot of street racing. But now they're talking about speed cameras in school zones where the camera would be running 24/7. And I just wanted to understand this and make sure I never want to be speeding. I got that. And especially during the school hours when that light's blinking there. But what's the idea behind making a speed camera in a school zone a 24/7 enforcement tool? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, first I'll say that this is sort of part of a broader ramp up of automated enforcement.
Right.
Across the state. The state is broadened the authority for local jurisdictions to install automatic cameras. We have a short story up this morning about, block the box and transit lanes.
Right.
Like that. I think the reason we're seeing that is sort of twofold, which is one, of course, more people are dying on Washington roads than basically ever before. And police, both at the state and local level, hold back pretty significantly from traffic enforcement. Mm-hmm. And so automated cameras are sort of seen as a way to fill those gaps.
Yeah.
I think the kind of ultimate goal of traffic enforcement cameras is they make themselves irrelevant, basically, that they are sort of a training mechanism. You get people to, they send out warnings, for example. You know, if you get caught at some of these, you don't get a ticket right away. And the hope is you sort of teach people that there is enforcement here and that you shouldn't be doing whatever behavior you were doing, you
know, right,
speeding in a school zone or driving in a transit lane. And so,
yeah,
you know, I think the thought with having it on 24 hours is you're training people around those areas to not speed in those particular areas. I'm sure that there are going to be some frustrated people who get school zone cameras at 2 a.m. and are going to wonder why. Mm-hmm. The hope, though, is you create a situation where people are just, not to ever speed in that particular area.
Yeah. Just one more twist here. I thought this was interesting in looking at what this is supposed to be. And I don't think it's supposed to be a revenue generator. But I will say, when these revenues start coming in 2024, the city is going to have to do something with them. They put off that decision, it looks like the city council did this week, in terms of where this is going to go, meaning a future council is going to have to decide where it goes with these revenues. And you've got these cameras, it looks like, with the Block the Box camp and those cameras that are used there, cost about $4,000 a month to keep them up, maintain them, etc. But those tickets, I think, are going to start to come in. And looking at that idea of this whole concept, you know, focusing on traffic safety, not gaining revenue, it's interesting to me. Do you have a concept about how much revenue could come in on this, I guess, and then where that should be going?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know for some of the cameras, I don't know if it's actually all of them or not, about half the money has to go to the state for the Cooper-Jones right. Safety Act. And I know the city in the past has spent some of the Block the Box transit violation money on, like, sick-proof signals.
Yep.
But as far as sort of broadly how they use it, you know, I would think the thought would be it would be, you know, something safety-related, which I think makes sense. There's a lot of revenue sources in the city, not a lot, but some revenue sources in the city where they necessarily decline over time, and so you don't want to, like, build yeah. in something long-term based on that revenue source. So, you know, finding something that can be sort of a strong upturn or upfront investment that doesn't yeah. need sort of ongoing funding for decades to come, I think would be sort of the trick.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how that goes too. All right, well, up next, folks, working on the budget here, 2 years in advance? Well, that's right. City leaders are so concerned about the year 2025 and the years following that, they've established a new revenue stabilization work group. What are they working on? We'll talk about it coming up on Now Hear This. Well, in case you missed it, the city's new revenue stabilization work group met this past week. They are looking at a big problem that appears to be coming home to roost in 2025. We're talking about a $200 million budget shortfall caused by a number of different factors, one of them being the tech industry slowdown, which is having an impact on the city's jumpstart payroll tax on big businesses, which are mainly tech in the city of Seattle. So a group has been put together to study this and consider other sources of revenue. And before you start running off and making recommendations for this year's budget, Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda has a message for you.
The conversation about levers, levels, priorities, reductions in the existing budget was not the charge of this work group. This work group was convened specifically to look at Seattle's tax structure and identify ways to make it more equitable and raise new progressive revenue.
I ran that soundbite because I wanted to make sure I stressed we are looking at the long term here and there are a lot of moving parts. But really at the root of this, folks, is the desire from some council members to not make jumpstart revenue simply a tool to shore up the budget, as it has been used over the past couple of years, and get it back to where it was intended, focused on affordable housing, Green New Deal initiatives. Overall, David, what do you make of the work that this group is putting in? We're talking about a pretty serious shortage of $200 million in a few years that could persist well into the future.
Yeah, I mean, the it's very Seattle problem or Washington state problem. There's not a lot of options at the local level for a city like Seattle to, around taxation. And so the question is, how do you find extra money or how do you cut enough to close that gap? I think Jumpstart is obviously a tempting source because it's a significant new source of revenue that probably the newest, most significant and largest new source of revenue to the city of Seattle, and at least since I've been covering Seattle that I can remember, beyond, you know, a new property tax levy or something like that. But so it has the advantage of it's been doing well as other revenue sources have not. So that, of course, makes it tempting. You know, the city has had these stakeholder groups sort of look at other possible progressive revenue sources they could bring in. You know, I have to say at first glance, the list is a little thin as far as viability and legality and, you know, significance, you know, how much money could actually bring in. Councilmember Peterson has proposed a capital gains tax at the local level now that the Supreme Court has seemed to sign off on that. That wouldn't surprise me that if Seattle went that direction. But, you know, the implementation of that could take a while. And some of these other sort of proposed revenue sources around whatever vacancy taxes or congestion taxes, those feel a little either difficult to implement far into the future and perhaps not actually that significant source of funds. So then the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce is pushing for the city to just cut more instead of add more taxes. So, this is a very classic kind of government government debate that we're having here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, and it's important to have it. And Councilmember Peterson is also talking about potentially taking a look at the city's pension system and looking for some cuts there. We'll see how that goes. And you bring up these different ideas here. There are 9 of them, folks. David has talked about a few of them. There's also a possible tax on high-paid CEOs. Portland and San Francisco are doing that. When a CEO makes at least 100 times more than the median worker. And then you've got these ideas about a tax on vacant residential units, charging tolls on congested roads, increasing sales tax on properties above $5 million, and even a city-level income tax. And I think you're onto something there, David, with regard to what it would take for some of these proposals to get off the ground and actually be something that would be a significant source of revenue. The other hurdle there that would be some of them would actually require some state help, meaning the state legislature would have to step in and say, yep, you're going to be able to do that, City of Seattle. And that's not an easy thing to do. So I guess I'm looking at this from the perspective Axios brought this up, and I thought this was an interesting point. Why not just take the jumpstart structure that you have in place and maybe tweak that a little bit, lower that threshold such that more businesses would be involved in it, something along those lines? Is that the right avenue to consider here? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know about right or wrong, but it's would probably be the simplest because the structure is there. And Councilmember Sawant had been pushing for that basically from the beginning, that, that the threshold on this should be lower. I think the threshold is what it is because of, you know, at the time when it was passed, there was a lot of sensitivity around what it would take to get a tax like this passed and then not repealed through a referendum, because, you know, the attempt before of the quote head tax that was widely seen as a political disaster and was on its way to being repealed by referendum. And so the city council just elected to roll it back. So I think there was a lot of tiptoeing in this second round, the jumpstart payroll tax. Since then, though, you know, it has become a source of money that has been fought over, even by people like, you know, the mayor, who is maybe not as enthusiastic about it as other council members were.
Yeah.
And yet there's really no talk about rolling that back. Any sort of organized opposition to it is doesn't exist as far as I can tell. And so, you know, I think the waters had been tested around this tax and it has floated. So I guess it wouldn't surprise me to see the city council think about sort of broadening that to increase revenue.
Okay. And I have noted the floated and waters tested. Mixed metaphors, but I'll take it, David, because we got to move on to our next piece here. Thank you for that. I did want to talk about another issue that I think might be under the radar as well for a lot of folks. The social housing developer Seattleites voted for with Initiative 135. Well, it got its first round of funding last week. $200,000 here. Not a ton, but this is mainly dollars from Seattle's state legislators. They had to step up to make this happen here in the summer to get this really going for the social housing developer, because Seattle's full budget process to requisition money doesn't happen until the fall. So this was part of the city's supplemental budget process that happens in the summer. Got it? Good. Okay. Again, folks, social housing is this model mainly used in Europe as mixed income units. The higher rents help subsidize the lower rents. System is mainly tenant run. And I bring this up, David, because I think social housing got over an important hurdle just to get started here. And the social housing supporters actually displayed last week what they can do with an empty lot of 4,000 square feet, impressive design they put out. But I'm just trying to figure out this next piece here. What's it going to take to get the mayor, as he puts together a budget this fall, and the council to really get on board with social housing? Because I think this could potentially be a pretty tense budget situation coming up.
Yeah, I don't know what it will take. You know, I think they had to go to the state to get some money for the social housing developer to get their operations up and running.
Right.
It's a tough time in state government to start a new entity because, as we just discussed, the organizations and the programs that are there are going to be fighting over money.
Yeah.
You know, I still have a lot of questions just about this organization. What it's going to take to get a social housing developer up and running generally, and what that's going to look like over the next 10 years. Not to say I'm doubtful or anything like that. I just, it's new, and I don't have a great sort of example of something like this getting up and running before. And so for me, it's all pretty new territory, and I wouldn't be surprised if that is the same sentiment in City Hall too.
Right. It does have voter support. It's important to point that out here. And I think the mayor and the council are going to be considering that. And I think you're going down the path that I was thinking about here too, David, which is the big knock on social housing. The long-term funding mechanism really wasn't part of the initiative votes. We don't really know what that's going to look like. And so I start thinking about, okay, the system gets established somehow this year. They find a CEO. Maybe they even start moving into buildings at some point and doing that type of thing. But it's still going to take a while to get revenue coming in that would actually make this self-supporting. I guess I'm trying to figure out, okay, how long does the council support this in the short term? Where's the money going to come from? What's it going to look like? How long is it going to take for this thing to start floating on its own? Any thoughts with that?
Yeah, I think that was the kind of big, I mean, there wasn't a ton of opposition to this when it went to the ballot, but I think that was why you saw, at least initially, some, frankly, fairly vocal, fairly high-profile social, you know, affordable housing developers or voices in the affordable housing not come out right away to support it. I think a lot of them ended up in the end supporting it, but I think there is a reality around just financing affordable housing that it's a really slow and lengthy process that requires, you know, federal government, state government, city government, private donors. You know, it just takes a while to get all your ducks in a row to build an affordable housing building, and sometimes 10 years. I think I remember covering a groundbreaking on an affordable housing building in like 2015 that I think just opened. So it takes a while. That's not to say that it's a bad idea. And if your goal is to build this kind of housing, you do have to start somewhere. But getting it to the point where it's churning out new units on a significant level is certainly going to take some time.
Yeah, it will. And I think what social housing supporters will tell you is that the way they have this set up, it doesn't require federal funding to get going. It actually has some thresholds there where it helps out people who are beyond what usually the federal government would help, meaning those people making 30% of the area median income or lower. This is a system that would actually support people making up to 150% of the area median income. So the hope is this will get a lot more people on board, and we will see something happening a little more quickly than this without a lot of that federal red tape. So we'll see. Again, the proof is in the pudding here, and we'll have to see where this goes. But a very interesting discussion ahead for social housing over the next couple months and years for the city here as it looks to support this program. All right, well, up next, ferry riders get ready to pay more to cross the water this year, possibly in the years ahead too. David's got the story next on Transportation Talk. David, you recently wrote in the Seattle Times about ferry fares going up by 4.25%, about 40 cents a trip on the state's bigger routes here. And that's going to be happening this year and then again next year. Tough one here because, as we have been talking about on this podcast, service has not been great, but here we are talking about prices going up. What's going on here?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is to fund operating expenses, and the reality is, you know, the legislature funds most of that, but And you know, there's some through taxes and things like that, but they, when they were writing their budget, left a gap that they would assume would be filled by ferry fare increases. And so that's really the reality here. Of course, the pandemic had a big effect on how much money the ferries were taking in through ridership, because that's still down for what it was recently, but 70-some percent of what it was pre-pandemic.
Yeah, 77%, you wrote, huh? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so, you know, and that's of 2019 level, so one would have thought that if the pandemic had not happened, those numbers would have continued to grow. So that, of course, is a hit and that they're trying to cover. Yeah. You know, the real, for me, kind of kicker, though, is they're doing this jump now, but it's possible it won't be enough because already they're, you know, they see ridership growing and it will likely continue to grow, but they're now revising their estimates and thinking that maybe it won't grow by as much as they thought.
Yeah. And can I jump in here? Because this really was the line that jumped out at me, David, from your story. So ridership, we've talked about this, not really what it was pre-pandemic. But even with higher fares, even with these higher fares, the result could still be a $9 million gap over 2 years. So this really brings back into the debate here long-term ferry funding, because even with these higher prices, it sounds like that's not going to cover what's needed for this system.
No, and I do think that this is a problem facing a lot of transit agencies, but the ferries rely, some transit agencies rely more on fares than others. I think SoundTransit, for example, it's a it's a good chunk of their budget, but it's not going to make or break that agency.
Yep.
Exactly what fairs do. I think it's more significant for state fairies because I don't remember exactly what the percentage is, but it's certainly a higher percentage than 10% of their operating expenses are covered through fares, which is why, you know, you pay $2 to get on a bus, but $9 to get on the ferry,
sure,
or whatever, 50 or whatever it is. So,
yeah.
You know, it's one of it's one of many problems facing the ferry system. Maybe the third most pressing problem behind staffing and the state of the fleet, but none, one nonetheless. You know, it's possible that they'll have to go back to the legislature and ask them for more money if that gap is not closed. Whether the legislature does that or not, I think it's going to be wrapped up in, again, these larger questions around how you keep the ferry system afloat, you know, both literally and metaphorically.
Yeah. One of the largest ferry systems in the entire world. It's always a great question to figure out what's happening with this because it's such a part of the way Seattle and the larger Puget Sound area gets around Western Washington, all across here, into Canada as well. A ton of talk about that with that all the time.
Technically part of the state's highway system.
Yeah. Good point. This is an important part of what we're talking about here. And I know we're going to keep on talking about it because David is on the case, but we do need to start wrapping up here, David. And it's been so interesting for me to watch our Mariners here. It's go time, definitely, for them. Nice 8-game win streak, followed by a 3-game losing streak as of the release of this podcast. So here's the big question, my man. Which one of these Jekyll and Hyde teams is going to show up in the last month and a half of the season? What do you got?
Yeah, I don't know. It's such a weird team because it feels like if they get into the playoffs and they get on one of those hot streaks, they have a shot at the World Series, you know, literally mm-hmm. because their pitching is
why
the
not?
Best.
Yeah, win 8 straight, that's a good sign. Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's a big if, whether they get into the playoffs or not. I don't know. I guess my prediction is they come up just short, but we'll see.
Oh, man, I know. It does feel like one of those seasons, doesn't it? We got to keep every single person healthy and keep them hitting and keep everybody pitching. I mean, so many different things have to line up here, but I'm excited about it. It's keeping me interested. How about that? And I think that's a good thing. So, well, thank you, David, as always, for joining me. Thank you to everybody listening to Seattle News, Views, and Brews, where you can always find out what's brewing in local politics. This podcast is on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you like to listen. Please also find Seattle News, Views, and Brews on Patreon, why don't you? And show us your support. You can also reach us via email at seattlenewsviewsandbrews@gmail.com. Spell them all out there, and we'd love to hear from you. Finally, thanks also for watching on Converge Media as well. We will see you next time. Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2023.